Hi, everybody. Cheryl Akison here. Welcome to another edition of the Cheryl Akison Podcast. I think you'll love today's episode. You're going to hear about some amazing original news stories, investigations, and inspiring journalism on fascinating and important topics, even though you may not have heard of these stories until now. It's enough to give you hope. I spent many years as a young journalist trying to figure out how to do my job well, training, cultivating sources, trying to become a clear, accurate, fair writer and reporter. Well, now I'm in my 60s, and the past couple of decades, I've spent a great deal of time reflecting not only on my training, my thought processes, what I did right, what I did wrong as a young journalist, but also looking at the media in the bigger picture, what we as an industry do well, what we don't do well. And I've written a lot about it. Some of you are probably familiar with my writings, including my books, where I address these topics. Well, one other thing that I've been doing in recent years is trying to figure out how I can help beyond criticizing or trying to look at things with a critical viewpoint and maybe having that voice be heard. And one thing I decided to do that I thought might actually have a hands-on impact is sponsor some awards at colleges and professional awards that reward the kind of reporting that I think people really want to see, that we don't get enough of. Because there are plenty of great reporters out there, and there is good work being committed, but it's not always going to be on a platform that's widely seen because of today's managed news environment. And it's certainly not going to be a story or a reporter investigation that garners top attention and awards. I judge the Emmy Awards every year, and I do see some great work, but I have to tell you that it seems to be a version of the same couple of stories over and over again, entered by the same media organizations, and not the original stories that are off the narrative, that are completely accurate and fair and interesting and impactful, but those don't tend to be entered or to win contests like these. So that's where I got the idea for the ION Awards. ION is an ION, investigative and original news. And the idea is to try to tell young reporters who are in journalism college, don't copy the bad habits at publications like the New York Times and the Washington Post, that used to be, I think, much greater newspapers and news organizations, but have really fallen short in recent years in ways that we all know about. They're biased, they're inaccurate, they make many, many mistakes. And if journalists think that's what they should aspire to, if that's what they're taught in journalism college, well, there's just going to be more of the same. So my idea was to simply start an award that recognizes the off-narrative or the original reporting that isn't what everybody else is reporting. And it has to be well-documented and accurate and fair and all the things that we want reporting to be, but it has to bring something a bit different to the table. And what I did was decide to award cash prizes. So I donate funds to give the winners several thousand dollars in the case of the student awards and the professional awards. And today in this podcast, we are going to go over some of the winners. I think you're going to be impressed. I know I was. For the student awards at the University of Florida, my alma mater, I did fund and sponsor them, but I didn't want to be the judge because I know too many people there, including some of the students. So there were other professors there that judged. I think they did a great job. And a lot of these students are under the tutelage now of someone I respect so much, Ted Brightus, who's a professor at the University of Florida, but I got to know him a bit when he was head of the investigative unit at Associated Press in Washington, D.C. He is a great, solid, old-fashioned journalist. He's teaching all the right things at the University of Florida to students. They're doing amazing work, even in college. They're doing work that is as good, if not better, than many professional, commercial organizations. So those awards were given in the last couple of months to a couple of students. We'll go over that. And then I just gave the Professional ION Awards. And I was prepared to award one person the $3,000 cash prize, or if there were plenty of award-worthy entries, maybe that prize would be divided up, and that's what we ended up doing. My co-judge in this case was Alberto Martinez at the University of Texas. He's a wonderful, fair-minded, critical thinker, and we think very much alike when it comes to the state of the media, fair reporting. I quoted him in one of my books because he is no Donald Trump fan. He was a Bernie Sanders supporter and voter, but he saw, like I did, the media treatment of Donald Trump and the not only exaggeration, but outright falsehoods furthered by the press. And his viewpoint was, like mine, you know, the press is there to report factually. And he said, in his view, Donald Trump had enough to criticize without lying about it, that he should just be reported on accurately and let people make up their own minds. And he wrote a great deal about this. So I thought he'd be a really good one to bring on board as a co-judge for the Professional ION Awards. He did a great job, and I really appreciate his time. This was time intensive. It took a lot of work and analysis. We did have a lot of good entries. So we're going to go over all of this today. And again, I think you will be pleasantly surprised by some of the journalism being committed out there that may not always get the recognition and attention that it deserves. Okay, first, who won the inaugural Student ION Awards? Well, the first place prize at the University of Florida went to journalism senior Tristan Wood for a two-part series on professor misconduct at Florida State University. The story reported on how FSU quietly fired one professor, suspended another who resigned a few months later, and allowed a third to remain on the job after it was determined they committed sexual misconduct in separate incidents with students. I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the reporting. Tristan Woods reports that the investigative reports that he obtained were obtained under Florida's public records law. One of the cases illustrates, he says, differences in rules at Florida's public universities and colleges regarding professors who have relationships with students. Some allow them in certain circumstances, others ban them. The university fired Ross May, 38, its associate director of FSU's Family Institute, which studies how parents can develop healthy environments for their children, over allegations that May pressured a student to get drunk, hugged her in a forceful way in a photograph, and bet another student $50 he could have sex with her by the end of the semester. The incidents allegedly occurred during 2019, and the investigation was completed in May of 2020. Skipping ahead a little bit in the article, May said in an interview he agreed to leave FSU despite what he called unfounded conclusions from the investigation. Quote, I honored their decision, and I was satisfied with vacating my position. He added, as someone who has spent considerable time trying to empirically understand the process of forgiveness, I apologize to anyone that might have felt slighted during the investigation, and I wish them well in their endeavors. Another professor, David Gilbert, 62, said he was suspended without pay for 2 weeks and later resigned after a graduate student accused him of sending her a sexually explicit email in January 2020. In the email, Gilbert described an erotic dream that included the student and said he hoped something like that would happen in the future. Quote, us mature guys like to work slowly, take our time and savor every minute, he wrote, according to the investigative report obtained by reporter Tristan Wood, a student at the University of Florida. If you'd like to read more on this, you can go to CherylAtkison.com and click the ION Awards tab. You'll be able to read about the ION Awards, but this will link to the winners and their stories. You can read them in their entirety. Another winner at the University of Florida was journalism senior Elise Elder, who received honorable mention for her story, former NYPD officers in Florida, heralded by DeSantis, include surprises. According to the story, the credentials and past behavior of some of the new hires, some of these former New York police officers, was suspect, including one previously fired as a Walmart security guard, one with only 3 years of experience who demanded more than double his salary, and others with mysterious gaps in their resumes. Elise Elder received $1,500 for her winning entry, and Tristan Wood received $3,500 for his. Now, on to the inaugural 2022 ION Awards for professional journalists. And again, it was very important to me to find a way to provide recognition for great reporting, accurate, fair, well-done journalism, excellence in my profession, in a way that's probably not going to be recognized these days by many of the traditional awards for a whole lot of different reasons that have to do with control of the information landscape, the fact that these kinds of stories will not usually be entered by the organization that sponsored them or where the reporters work. They're not likely to be entered in many traditional awards if they're off the narrative when the stories are even published at all. And I accepted and looked at awards from, I guess, what you would call non-traditional outlets as well. Happy to look at the ones from networks and traditional print organizations. But I also wanted to look to see if reporting at outlets that are less traditional or not thought of in the same way as the legacy news organizations, if there was some great reporting there. And there was, there has been, there is. Helping me judge these professional awards was my co-judging partner, Professor Alberto Martinez at the University of Texas. Why did I pick a co-judge? Well, I wanted someone to help me. I didn't want to be the only one to judge these awards, but I did have some specific ideas and criteria in mind. I also wanted to have at least one co-judge in the event that somebody I knew well or a friend of mine happened to enter the awards. That didn't happen, but this was sort of a safety in case that happened. We would find a way for the judge that didn't know these people to work them into the scoring system. And Professor Martinez generously agreed to help me. I mean, this was time-consuming. It's not something he's doing for his own benefit. But I know him to be someone who's very interested in good journalism, even though people who know him may know he comes from a left-leaning perspective, an admitted Bernie Sanders supporter who opposed President Trump but was fair-minded enough to be someone who wrote about the media bias against President Trump. So again, this is someone who didn't support Trump, in fact, opposed Trump, but understood, as I did, that the media coverage of Trump was often false, misleading, and completely irresponsible. And I knew Professor Martinez would be able to look at entrants not from a political perspective, which I think happens too often today, but just look at them purely from a perspective of importance, accuracy, fairness, all the things that we like to see in a great news report, at least in a traditional sense. I was prepared to give at least one winning award for first place. And if there were other entrants that seemed extremely worthy or close to the first place, I was prepared to split the $3,000 prize that I was offering among all of them. Maybe it would be one or two or three. And this being the inaugural year for the awards, I tried to make it really simple this year for the entrants. Very easy application process, not a whole lot of different categories and submission requirements, because let me tell you, it's practically a full-time job for somebody to enter some of these awards. It's so complicated. So much detail and technical stuff is required. So I didn't want that. And I also knew that subsequent years, I can make adjustments as needed. But let's start with the third of three winners that we awarded. I would kind of call this third place, although what I did was give a first place and more or less two other mentions that are basically tied. But let's say third place for the sake of this description was a terrific piece by somebody named Todd Shepard. Let me read the description that I and my co-judge, Professor Martinez, wrote up about this winning entry. In 2020, billionaire Mark Zuckerberg and his wife, Priscilla Chan, donated more than $350 million to the nonprofit Center for Tech and Civic Life to increase voter participation, ostensibly irrespective of political affiliations. Their money was distributed to multiple states and doled out by government officials in select counties. However, Todd Shepard's investigation in Broad and Liberty revealed ethical, political, and transparency issues. Using right-to-know requests to the Pennsylvania government, Shepherd found that such grants were awarded disproportionately to Democrat-leaning Pennsylvania counties ahead of the 2020 presidential election. For example, four blue counties each received more Zuck Bucks than all of the red counties combined. Pennsylvania's Secretary of State handpicked which counties to invite to apply for grants and chose when to invite them. The infusion of private funds created disparities in how government officials treated voters. Shepherd's subsequent report showed that partisan operatives colluded behind the scenes. His reporting was cited in subsequent bipartisan legislation in the Pennsylvania House and Senate and calls for reform, including Senate Bill 982. Presently, more than 20 states have enacted legislation, this is since the 2020 election, to ban the infusion of private funds into the government's election processes. Now, I also reported on this phenomenon on my TV program, Full Measure. Shepherd's winning entry was published in April of 2021. You can find that linked in the announcement about the awards on the homepage right now of my website at CherylAckison.com. Or if you happen to be listening to this sometime after early to mid-July, you could search at CherylAckison.com under ION, I-O-N, or click the ION Awards tab and you'll be able to find this material. It's worth reading. It's very good journalism. Shepherd did at least six reports on this topic. The winning entry was April 13th, 2021. I will read you an excerpt from that report. Shepherd wrote, "Democrats and even a judge who heard a complaint on the matter rebuffed these claims," referring to claims that there was bias in the award of these supposedly nonpartisan grants of money, "rebuffed these claims by pointing to grants given by CTCL, the nonprofit, to some counties in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania that had voted for Trump by a 2-to-1 margin in 2016. But while it is true that the CTCL, that organization, gave grants to red counties like Luzerne, Erie, and Mifflin, those grants were a fraction of what was given to bluer counties, especially in the southeast." Shepherd goes on to write, for example, "Luzerne County received a grant of just over $173,000, averaging out 78 cents per registered voter. Erie County's grant of $148,729 came to 73 cents per registered voter." So this is me talking. Those are some of the red counties that received this outside money of 78 cents per registered voter and 73 cents per registered voter. Shepherd writes, "Meanwhile, Philadelphia, which is blue or Democrat dominant, and the collar counties enjoyed grants several times larger. Delaware County," this is in Pennsylvania, "Delaware County's grant of $2.2 million boosted election spending by $5.17 per registered voter." So again, me talking, compare $5.17 per voter to 78 cents per voter or 73 cents per voter in the red or Republican areas. While Chester County's $2.5 million averaged $6.57 per registered voter, again in a blue or Democrat-heavy county. Shepherd writes, "These suburban collar counties were essential to flipping the state of Pennsylvania, even as Republicans increased their vote counts in Philadelphia itself. On a raw dollar basis," Shepherd writes, "both Chester and Delaware," again Democrat counties, "received more from their respective grants than the total doled out to all of the red counties combined. Meanwhile, the $10 million in change granted to Philadelphia came to an astonishing $8.87 to spend per registered voter, roughly 12 times more than the per voter award to the Republican-heavy Luzerne or Erie counties. And so Philadelphia's grant was five times larger than the largest red county grant." And Shepherd did a good job using data and facts to support his reporting, which is one of the important things I and Professor Martinez looked for. He has a graph that might be interesting for you to look at that shows the grant money per registered voter, and he's organized it from the least amount of money to the highest amount of money. And you can visually see the point pretty clearly because he's marked the Republican areas red when they got grants and the Democrat areas blue when they got grants. And the most grant money, the tallest bars on the graph, are blue. The short ones are red. So strong reporting from Todd Shepard is published in a publication called Broad and Liberty, and that gets him this recognition plus a $500 cash award. Next recognition goes to Jay Avila for his investigation entitled Government and Activists Bailout Criminals. This aired on News 4 San Antonio, Texas, WOIA-TV. In a thorough, fair, and compelling presentation, Avila revealed how Bexar County officials are assisting a controversial bail reform program that has bonded out hundreds of inmates, including habitual offenders, amid rising crime. Despite the noble goal of providing help to poor minorities, the Texas Organizing Project, TOP, bails out what they call low-level offenders, irrespective of whether previously they have been repeatedly indicted or convicted of violent crimes. Avila's reporting is well-documented and even-handed, including interviews with a representative from the bail organization, TOP, the Bexar County Sheriff, and the Bexar County District Attorney. Avila showed that the sheriff and the district attorney both received large campaign contributions from TOP. Within the tight strictures of a television newscast, Avila's succinct report combined verifiable information with illuminating analysis. Here now is audio of that winning TV report.
New tonight, with homicides and property crimes rising in San Antonio and other U.S. cities, some are questioning more lenient bail practices.
Yeah, are they putting repeat offenders back on the street? And why is Bexar County helping? News 4 troubleshooter Jay Avila investigates what's happening at the county jail and the battle over bail.
The county and the bail reform group it's working with say cash bail discriminates against the poor and that inmates should be released on little to no bond if they pose little risk to society. But records show some they've bonded out have extensive criminal records and a history of not showing up to court.
The disturbing thing that we're looking at with the violent crime.
Police Chief William McManus mentioned bail as a factor last month when announcing San Antonio's 30% increase in homicides and jump in property crime.
Because there's not a whole lot of pretrial detention going on right now. Most of these folks are getting out.
Since 2020, a group called the Texas Organizing Project, or TOP, has bailed out 741 inmates from the Bexar County Jail.
This is the list of individuals that we've identified for bailout.
TOP is one of the organizations behind last year's Defund the Police movement.
All right, I got 7 bonds today.
Now it's focusing on bailing out what it calls low-level offenders with bail amounts of $5,000 or less.
Because many poor people are sitting in jail without legally being found guilty of a crime, and they should have the same rights as those that are being charged with the same exact crime and have wealth and are able to be bailed out.
Bexar County says it doesn't have a list of inmates bonded out by TOP, but we were able to research some cases. Ernest Saldana was bailed out for felony meth possession, a low-level charge. But the police report says Saldana had gone into a women's restroom at a convenience store with a knife. Saldana was charged as a repeat offender, indicted for shooting and stabbing a female companion in 2006. Gilbert Vasquez was also bonded out by TOP for meth possession and evading arrest. He was charged as a habitual offender with 44 cases on his record, including assault, robbery, and theft. Neither Saldana nor Vasquez showed up to court after TOP bonded them out. We found numerous other inmates with long criminal histories who now have active warrants out for their arrest after TOP bonded them out.
Do some of these defendants belong in jail?
Again, I would have to say that everyone's entitled to bail.
And Bexar County agrees with TOP. In fact, we've learned the county supplies the group with a weekly list of people for them to bond out. And when a TOP defendant fails to appear in court, The Bexar County public defender represents Topp in the case so it doesn't lose the bail money, something that is not done for bail bond companies. Sheriff Javier Salazar says Topp has helped keep the jail population down during COVID.
What we may be seeing with regard to violent crime, every other major city and county in the United States is seeing it.
So you don't attribute that to the bail reform initiative?
I don't.
There was outrage last year when a man named Daryl Brooks drove through a parade in Milwaukee, killing six people, 2 days after walking out of jail on a $1,000 bond for trying to run over the mother of his child.
This one here.
And here in San Antonio, victim advocates are concerned about the bailouts. Convicted murderer Derek Rodriguez was free on bond when he shot Abel Salazar and stuffed him in a trash can.
How many have lost a loved one because the system is just letting them out like if nothing, giving them one chance after another chance after another chance?
But bail reform has been adopted in cities across the nation. Groups that support it have spent millions to help elect district attorneys and other leaders who agree with their cause. Campaign finance records show Texas Organizing Project performed canvassing and field operations for Sheriff Salazar in the amount of more than $16,000 and did about $76,000 worth of campaign work for Bexar County DA Joe Gonzalez. A political action committee that supports bail reform, funded by billionaire George Soros, also contributed an unprecedented $1.4 million worth of advertising and research for DA Gonzalez's campaign since 2018. The district attorney says the contributions are not the reason Topp receives cooperation from the county on its bailout efforts.
Because they supported me does not reflect on how we operate our office and our recommendations at the magistrate's office with regard to recommending low-level bonds.
A new law passed by the legislature will require more transparency by groups like Topp that bail out defendants. The sheriff will have to maintain a list of their bailouts and report them to the state. We've also learned that Harvard University will soon launch a project to study bail reform here at the Bexar County Jail. I'm News 4 troubleshooter Jay Avila.
You can see his report, the video version of it, also linked at the same announcement at CherylAxon.com, where you can see all of the information about the ION Awards. Next, I think you'll be interested in the first place winner of the inaugural 2022 ION Awards for Investigative and Original News Reporting, so stay with us. Much more after a short break. In this age of a highly controlled media landscape, it's never been more important to support truly independent journalism. Go to CherylAkison.com and click the store tab for a great way to do that. We just designed some thought-provoking beach towels for summer you'll love to show off and make a statement with at the beach or the pool, or hang them in your guest bathroom. They feature catchphrases like, "I tested positive for critical thinking," and "Do your own research, make up your own mind, think for yourself." Proceeds support independent journalism causes like the ION Awards for Off-Narrative Accurate Reporting. Visit CherylAkison.com and click the Store tab. We are back talking about some great journalism that I think it's important you hear about. I think it'll make you feel good to know this sort of reporting is taking place and that I've taken steps to try to provide some recognition for it. I might mention that the cash awards I'm donating for the ION Awards, the Investigative and Original News Reporting, both for students and professional reporting, that award money is made possible in part by the generous donations that you all have made, either from purchases at the Cheryl Akison store at CherylAkison.com, where there's some fun products and the proceeds go to support independent journalism, or for other donations directly made on my website. This is the sort of thing I try to figure out to do with the money in ways that could help the general journalism landscape. I'm at about $100,000 in me donating to such causes so far over the past couple of years, and I plan to continue to try to do this in a way that's meaningful and makes sense and does justice to the money that's donated. So many of you have written or contacted me and asked over the years how they can support independent journalism efforts. And this is, again, what I've done with some of those funds. So on to first place, the ION Award winner is Paul Thacker, a freelance reporter for a story he wrote called Pfizer's Problematic Vaccine. The previous entrants won $500 apiece, but the grand prize award to Thacker was $2,000, a cash award. And Paul Thacker's groundbreaking and important investigation, Pfizer's Problematic Vaccine, originated not in a traditional news outlet, but in the British medical journal, BMJ, one of the top medical journals in the world. This in itself is an interesting story because not too long ago, this is the type of story that would have been broken by a reporter working for CBS News, maybe somebody like me when I worked there, or at NBC or the Washington Post or the New York Times. But these days, as you may know, those traditional news organizations are staying away from some of the best reporting out there, either for reasons of corporate conflicts of interest, in my view, such as stories connected to the pharmaceutical industry, which funds so much of the media and so many politicians today, or they're avoiding stories because they perceive the stories are damaging to the media bosses' political viewpoints, or they think that it would generate controversy and pushback from certain constituents and they don't want to take the heat or fight those battles. So much journalism isn't being published on the basis of whether it's important and accurate and fair. But anyway, the British Medical Journal, kudos to them for publishing a story that should have been done by a journalism organization. Thacker revealed serious issues with Pfizer's pivotal COVID-19 vaccine clinical trial, including poor laboratory management, patient safety concerns, and data integrity issues. This is super important. Think of how many millions and millions of people got the COVID vaccine. Ventavia was a contractor running Pfizer's clinical trials, and using clear documentation, Thacker traced what happened when a whistleblower, Ventavia Regional Director Brooke Jackson, reported the missteps to the FDA. So again, this is somebody working for Pfizer that blew the whistle in a very credible way to the Food and Drug Administration. What happened? Well, she was fired the same day. And yet, internal company documents, emails, audio recordings, photos, and two other employees confirmed Jackson's concerns. Thacker's article was meticulously well-documented and sourced. He had the benefit of the best kind of source possible. He interviewed the whistleblower on the record, who was a credible, high-ranking official involved in the story, providing verifiable firsthand information. Think about the difference between that and so many stories we've seen in major news publications in the past couple of years that were based on anonymous sources who proved wrong, and some of those stories won top journalism awards. This is a report in British Medical Journal that had the best kind of information, verifiable, on the record, and Thacker followed up with articles in his Substack newsletter called The Disinformation Chronicle. His investigations generated news reports here in the United States, Italy, the UK, and South Korea. He also worked to highlight the enormous profits Pfizer made from the vaccine. So his winning entry was COVID-19, researcher blows the whistle on data integrity issues in Pfizer's vaccine trial, but he also wrote these two other notable articles in the Disinformation Chronicle. One was called Pfizer COVID-19 Vaccine Clinical Trial Whistleblowers Documents Released, and Reporters Expose Pfizer Misinformation and Power to Demand Eye-Popping Vaccine Profits. Let me read a bit from the beginning of the medical journal article that we awarded the winning prize to. In autumn 2020, Pfizer's chairman and chief executive, Albert Bourla, released an open letter to the billions of people around the world who were investing their hopes in a safe and effective COVID-19 vaccine to end the pandemic. Quote, "As I've said before, we are operating at the speed of science," Bourla wrote, explaining to the public when they could expect a Pfizer vaccine to be authorized in the U.S. But for researchers who were testing Pfizer's vaccine at several sites in Texas during that autumn, speed may have come at the cost of data integrity and patient safety. A regional director who is employed at the research organization Ventavia Research Group has told the British Medical Journal that the company falsified data, unblinded patients, employed inadequately trained vaccinators, and was slow to follow up on adverse events reported in Pfizer's pivotal Phase 3 trial. Staff who conducted quality control checks were overwhelmed by the volume of problems they were finding. After repeatedly notifying Ventavia of these problems, the regional director, Brooke Jackson, emailed a complaint to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Ventavia fired her later that same day. Jackson has provided the British Medical Journal with dozens of internal company documents, photos, audio recordings, and emails. And also, I might add, the British Medical Journal published a video interview with whistleblower Brooke Jackson. Jackson reported and documented so many problems that are recounted in this article, I think most people would find this shocking. For example, some of the concerns that she witnessed or she told the FDA about were participants were placed in a hallway after injection, not being monitored by clinical staff, lack of timely follow-up of patients who experienced adverse events from the COVID-19 vaccine, protocol deviations not being reported, vaccines not being stored at proper temperatures, mislabeled lab specimens, and targeting of Ventavia staff for reporting these types of problems. Now, if you followed issues with prescription drugs in the pharmaceutical industry and the FDA over the years as I have, maybe you know that a lot of times the problem also lies within the FDA, with too many inside the FDA, particularly at high levels, coordinating, I guess you could say, with the pharmaceutical industry on behalf of the corporation, not so much, critics would say, on behalf of patient interest or consumer interest. Well, according to the British Medical Journal and Thacker's article, within hours of writing her concerns to the FDA, Jackson received an email from the FDA thanking her for her concerns and notifying her that the FDA could not comment on any investigation that might result. A few days later, she received a call from an FDA inspector to discuss her report, but was told no further information could be provided. And she heard nothing further. In Pfizer's briefing document submitted to an FDA advisory committee, the meeting held on December 10, 2020, to discuss Pfizer's application for emergency use authorization of the COVID-19 vaccine, the company made no mention of problems at the Ventavia site. Again, this was the contractor that was conducting some of these crucial tests. The next day, the FDA issued the authorization for the vaccine. Then, according to the British Medical Journal, in August, after the full approval of Pfizer's vaccine, the FDA published a summary of the inspections that it conducted of the company's pivotal trial or study. 9 of the study's 153 sites were inspected. Again, this is me talking, not what was written in the British Medical Journal, but think about how fast all of this was rushed through, and with good reason, but how careful the FDA should be when looking at the processes involved. Well, looks like they only looked at 9 of 153 sites where patients were being tested. Ventavia sites were not listed among the 9 inspected. So kind of surprising that you would have a high-level person and an important contractor report these problems to the FDA, and then in the end, the FDA doesn't even inspect any of the Ventavia sites, or at least doesn't list any among those inspected. I hope you'll take the time to look at the link to this article, again found on my website in the Ion Awards announcement, and read the whole thing, because this kind of journalism, as important as it is, doesn't get the sort of attention and distribution that it deserves or that's commensurate with its importance amid today's managed media environment. I think you'll agree with me that these works of journalism are worthy of the Ion Awards and deserving of a great deal of attention in a very challenging information landscape. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast, and that if so, you'll leave a great review, subscribe to it, and share it with your friends. Check out my other podcast, Full Measure After Hours. And now you can support independent journalism by visiting CherylAtkisson.com and clicking the store tab. There are some thought-provoking and fun products designed exclusively for independent and free thinkers like you, with proceeds benefiting independent reporting causes. Do your own research, make up your own mind, think for yourself.